Wonderful. Good to see you all tonight. Welcome to our third class in this course called Uniting Wisdom and Compassion. Let's begin as we usually do with a recitation of a few prayers. I just need to have my screen share enabled, and then I can do that. And after the prayers, we'll do a short meditation, reflecting a little bit on what we talked about towards the end of last week in terms of bodhicitta having these two sort of objects or main orientations, one towards the beings that we want to benefit, and of course the other towards our own enlightenment, so we can do that. Still, I'm not able to share the prayers. Let's see.
Don, I feel to make you a co-host, which would help a lot if I would do that, wouldn't it?
That would do the trick, I think.
We get the deal.
That's all right. We all have a lot on our plates these days, so.
All right. Now you should.
Okay. I'm there. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Donna. All right. Let's go ahead and recite this praise to Shakyamuni Buddha three times. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. We do the short mandala offering, making this vast, pure offering that we're visualizing. We can receive the blessings of all the holy beings and become just like them. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. And then finally, refuge in bodhicitta, bringing to mind these two thoughts as we recite this first in English and then twice in the Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chanyen gipe sanam gi dola penchir sangye drupar shok sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chanyen gipe sanam gi dola penchir sangye drupar shok. Okay, let's go ahead and do a short meditation then. Again, just a few minutes of focused meditation on the breath, just to kind of come into this space with a calm mind, a bit more focus. And then after a few minutes in meditation on the breath, however you want to work with the breath, I'll come in and lead you in a short reflection on bodhicitta, as I said, recalling these two main elements of bodhicitta that we discussed last week. So begin the meditation now. So now let's set our motivation. And in last week's class, we spoke again to this idea of bodhicitta having two objects, two aspirations. The object of intent is the wish to benefit all beings, to enact their welfare, to bring them to the complete fulfillment of their potential. And the second object, the object of attainment, is that we have to accomplish our own Buddhahood in order to do that. So let's begin by looking at the object of intent, because this is really central to bodhicitta, and it's, of course, rooted in compassion, the main topic that we're discussing in this course. So to reflect and generate compassion, you know, for sentient beings, let's use the Four Noble Truths, which we commemorated the Buddha's teaching of those Four Noble Truths just yesterday. So we can think about ourselves and all beings in this predicament of being in samsara, dealing with the First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha, the dissatisfaction that we experience continually. It arises in the form of pain, difficulties at times, but it also arises in terms of the changeability of even our pleasant experiences. But it's there all the time in the form of this pervasive, conditioned dukkha or suffering. We're always under the control of factors that will lead us into this unsatisfactory condition that we are in. And the second noble truth, the causes of this are within beings themselves. The root of ignorance that requires the wisdom of emptiness in order to be completely eliminated and removed. And from that ignorance, the other states of mind that we have arising that bring forth karma, the actions we engage in that ripen into our results, our experiences that we have in the countless lifetimes we've endured in samsara. So all of the causes of this state of suffering that we find ourselves in are within our own minds. All starts from the root of ignorance, and everything else that is generated from that root. So thinking about other beings in that same situation that you yourself are in, experiencing samsara under the control of these causes, recognize the two other noble truths, that it doesn't have to be this way. There can be a complete cessation, an end to our own suffering and the suffering of others, and all the causes of suffering removed completely. And of course, to do that, we have to accomplish the fourth noble truth, the path that leads to that, to engage fully in the Buddha's teachings all the way to the culmination of our potential in the state of Buddhahood. That this is possible for all sentient beings. So when we observe them in terms of their suffering, we also can observe them in terms of the end of their suffering. In fact, the Buddha himself said he came to teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. So within that awareness, generate compassion, a compassionate wish, first of all, of how wonderful it would be if these beings were free from all that suffering, all the causes of suffering. And then the thought, may they be free from suffering and its causes. And then to make this into that object of intent that is part of bodhicitta, the thought, I myself will do this for them. I will lead them out of suffering. I will protect them from suffering. This is the great compassion that becomes this object of intent that is set upon benefiting all beings to the greatest degree, freeing them from suffering once and for all. And really feel that compassion in your heart that goes out to all beings without exception. And then to combine it with the object of attainment, we simply have to ask ourselves the question, well, can I do this right now? Can I benefit beings to that degree? Or do I need to become more capable? And this is where we come to the conclusion that without attaining our own enlightenment, we won't be able to benefit others to that degree. We can't even benefit ourselves. So we generate the mind that is intent upon achieving our own enlightenment, so we then can be dedicated fully to helping others to do the same. Both the object of attainment and the object of intent, making up the essence of bodhicitta, these two aspirations. And just bring that very deeply into your heart, so everything we do tonight becomes a cause for the result of our own enlightenment, and moreover, the enlightenment of each and every single sentient being. Okay. Hey, wonderful. Again, good to see you all tonight. We are carrying on with our working through these verses of Master Chandrakirti, who wrote the supplement to the Middle Way. And so I'm going to go ahead and put the verses on the screen, and we can recite those together. We've gone through the first verse in its entirety. It's a six-line verse, and we're going to go on tonight, after we conclude a little discussion on that last part, to verse 2. But let's go ahead and recite these, and then the remaining verses, verse and a half that we have. Hearers and middling realizers of suchness are born from the kings of subduers. Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. The mind of compassion, non-dual understanding, and the altruistic mind of enlightenment are the causes of children of conquerors. Mercy alone is seen as the seed of a conqueror's rich harvest, as water for development, and as ripening in a state of long enjoyment. Therefore, at the start, I praise compassion. Homage to that compassion for migrators who are powerless like a bucket traveling in a well, through initially adhering to a self, an I, and then generating attachment for things. This is mine. Homage to that compassion for migrators seen as evanescent and empty of inherent existence, like a moon in rippling water. Whoops. Anyway, that's the verses that we are looking at in this course, to this whole idea of uniting our compassion with wisdom, with the wisdom teachings of the Buddha that tell us the predicament that we ourselves and others are in, as well as, again, the various ways that we are distorting reality, not seeing things correctly. So this is what we're going to continue examining tonight. We've been working with these verses using Master, Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on Master Chandrakirti's text. So, well, first of all, yeah, let me go back to this. This was handout 2. And again, this is where we're at in terms of understanding. We just read the verses pertaining to this, but it started off by saying these Hinayana, or fundamental vehicle practitioners, the hearers and solitary realizers, or middling realizers, as they're often called, these arise from Buddhas, the kings of subduers. Well, where do Buddhas come from? Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. Where do bodhisattvas come from? They come from the three practices, the causes of a bodhisattva. The mind of great compassion, as we're seeing, is the root of those three. The other two come from that. Non-dual awareness and the altruistic mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta. So we'll continue looking at these and get a little bit more explanation behind what each of these mean. But we're working with, again, Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary that's called Illumination of the Thought, and we're on specifically page 8, I believe, yeah. So we were about midway through, almost exactly halfway through this page, assigning these three practices, ones we just looked at, great compassion, non-dual understanding, and then the bodhicitta, the altruistic mind of enlightenment, as the causes of bodhisattvas, is the system of Nagarjuna's precious garland. Remember, Nagarjuna is the person who wrote the text that Chandrakirti is commenting on, in a sense, supplementing Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom. But this is another text he wrote, a very wonderful text called Precious Garland. He says there, if you and the world wish to gain the highest enlightenment, its roots are, one, an altruistic aspiration to enlightenment, firm like Mount Meru, the king of mountains. Secondly, compassion reaching in all directions, the great compassion that we're mostly discussing here. And third, the wisdom which relies not on duality. So it says this passage indicates that these three are the roots of enlightenment, but does not explicitly show that these are the roots of a bodhisattva. However, since root means beginning, you know, the beginning point from which other things arise, Nagarjuna is indicating the three main causes of the beginning of a bodhisattva. And thus it can be known from the context that these are the main causes of bodhisattvas. So remember, I pointed this out last week, this chart that I have made available to you that comes from the when our studies in the master's program kind of puts together the Mahayana path. Over on the left-hand side is before one even enters the path formally. These three main causes, they give rise to a novice bodhisattva, a bodhisattva who enters into the path of accumulation. Once one enters that path, that consciousness, you are a bodhisattva because you have uncontrived bodhicitta at that point, a higher level of the altruistic mind of enlightenment that is with us all the time, that is pervading our sort of being. And then we go on through the remaining paths, the path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and then achieving the path of no more learning on the far right there, the state of Buddhahood. But again, these are the causes, as Lama Tsongkhapa is saying, of a bodhisattva. So we're going to look at them again in a little more detail as we go through the commentary. So then Lama Tsongkhapa says, Chandrakirti's teaching these three practices as the causes of bodhisattvas occurs at the time of analyzing the doubt, if hearers and solitary realizers are born from Buddhas, just as we saw a few seconds ago, and Buddhas from bodhisattvas, then from what are bodhisattvas born? You know, what is the cause of bodhisattvas? Therefore, these three are not suitable to be causes for positing someone as a bodhisattva. In other words, not the definition of a bodhisattva. They are the causes that produce a bodhisattva. The causes always precede the effect. You know, this is sort of the law of causality that the Buddha taught. So these three act as the causes for producing this initial bodhisattva who enters into the Mahayana path. So now we get some objections, which do actually help to clarify some of the points. This objector begins by saying, is the lowest type of bodhisattva in relation to whom these three practices are assigned as causes a novice bodhisattva who has just entered the path or not? If he is, or they are, then it is incorrect to assign the altruistic mind generation of the Mahayana as a cause, because as soon as that bodhisattva attains such a mind generation, they are a bodhisattva. So it's kind of like if we say this is a fully qualified altruistic mind of enlightenment, meaning the uncontrived mind of enlightenment, that again, if I go back to that chart, that is what this demarcation of this circle two is. This is uncontrived bodhicitta. One precedes it with meditating on the mind of enlightenment in the same way that we all do when we look at the techniques for generating bodhicitta, the sevenfold cause and effect method, the equalizing and exchanging self and others technique. When we do those, we are cultivating a taste of bodhicitta. When we actually get it to this uncontrived level, that's when we become a bodhisattva. So at that point, it becomes the definition of a bodhisattva. What is a bodhisattva? A being with uncontrived bodhicitta. And that would go from the beginning of the path of accumulation all the way to the end of the path of meditation before they become a Buddha. So essentially, that's how we would define a bodhisattva. So there, the objector is saying, well, okay, if this is a novice bodhisattva, well, then you're saying that the altruistic mind of enlightenment that's uncontrived is a cause, but it's not a cause. It's what happens that is simultaneous with becoming a bodhisattva. So then it says, continuing that last part of the bottom of page 8, moreover, it is not feasible to assign, let me put the screen up a bit, the wisdom that does not rely on the two extremes as a cause of a bodhisattva. This is because that bodhisattva initially generates a conventional mind of enlightenment and then trains in the bodhisattva deeds, the six perfections, and thus only when training in the perfection of wisdom does that bodhisattva train in the wisdom not relying on the two extremes. So this is the second part of the objection. It's essentially saying, okay, the first one is, if you're saying that bodhicitta is what is the cause of a bodhisattva, well, no, bodhicitta arises at the same moment that bodhisattva is established. But they're talking about, we're going to see, two different types of bodhicitta, the bodhicitta that precedes that uncontrived mind versus the mind that is uncontrived that becomes part of defining what we mean by a bodhisattva. But then secondly, the objector raises some issues with this initial novice bodhisattva having the wisdom that is free from the two extremes. Because when we generally talk about wisdom free from the two extremes, that's non-dual. We mean a direct realization of emptiness. Non-dual. Somebody's coming in from outer space. Not sure where that's from. Okay. So when we talk about non-dual understanding of emptiness, oftentimes we're talking about the non-dualistic occurrence that is on the path of seeing and above, when the Bodhisattva has a direct realization of emptiness. It's said to be non-dual, and that, of course, it is free from these extremes of permanence and annihilation. But nonetheless, and I'll talk about those in a moment, nonetheless, it's also free from this duality of sort of the subjective awareness that is knowing the object emptiness. These two, for us, whenever we have a subjective mind and an object appearing to it, it's always dualistic. There's never this lack of any dualistic quality to it. There's always a separation between the object that is being known and the consciousness that is knowing that. So anyway, the idea is that when you achieve this direct realization of emptiness, emptiness and the mind realizing emptiness merge, they say, like water poured into water. And you no longer have any differentiation of the subjective awareness that is knowing the object emptiness. This is a profound experience. It doesn't happen until the path of seeing. Remember, the path of seeing is way further along on our little chart here. I can go back and show that again to you. There's a conceptual understanding for this bodhisattva who's newly entering the Mahayana on the path of accumulation and path of preparation, but it becomes non-conceptual, and you have that direct realization when you enter into the path of seeing, and then you continue with that non-dual understanding of emptiness all the way through whenever you have a meditation on emptiness that acts as an antidote to another level of the obscurations that get removed until you become a Buddha. And when you become a Buddha, you're never parted from that non-dual wisdom. So this objector is essentially saying, well, how can you be talking about this non-dual wisdom at this point? And we're talking about somebody over here who's entering into the bodhisattva path, who wouldn't, you know, necessarily have that. If they have completed the Hinayana path, then they would have that non-dual understanding of emptiness. But most bodhisattvas are entering the Mahayana newly, freshly, and they wouldn't have that understanding at all because they've never experienced a non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness. So this is the second part of the objection. It has to do more with the wisdom aspect of it. The first one had to do with bodhicitta and bodhicitta being that cause, and then now also the questioning of this non-dual wisdom. How can that be a cause when it's not developed until the bodhisattva is engaging in the perfections and perfecting wisdom in this way that I just described? Okay, so that's the first part of the question, in saying if this is a novice bodhisattva, then we have two problems. Then he goes on to say, on the other hand, if the lowest type of bodhisattva in relation to whom these three are posited as causes is not taken as a novice bodhisattva, who has just entered the path, then it would contradict the explanations given earlier that this lowest type of bodhisattva is like the new moon and like the shoot of a medicinal tree. He'll recall that from our previous class where we looked at the idea of the bodhisattva being praised as being the shoot, from which the whole medicinal tree will arise and so on. Okay, so the answer that's given by Tsongkhapa says, first, we don't assert the second position. We don't say that this isn't this novice bodhisattva, that, you know, we don't say it's some other bodhisattva at some other level of the path. It is the novice bodhisattva, you know, because otherwise you would have the fault. You would incur the fault as explained. So then he goes on to say, therefore, the first position is asserted. This is a novice bodhisattva that we are talking about, those being the causes of, but it doesn't entail the fault stated above. First, in regard to the first fault that had to do with bodhicitta, the mind generation that precedes a bodhisattva, this is what refers, in this context, it refers to the time of cultivating bodhicitta, or what's called mind generation in some texts, not to an actual mind generation, meaning that uncontrived mind of bodhicitta that has been produced through having cultivated it. The difference between these two mind generations is like that between tasting the bark of a sugar cane and the inside of sugar cane, where the actual sugar crystals are. You know, because the mere thought, I will attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings, is just verbal understanding, it is like tasting the bark of sugar cane. And although it is called an altruistic mind generation, it is not fully qualified. You know, it's not the complete bodhicitta that we have when we enter the path and become a bodhisattva. So, through having trained in this mind of enlightenment in accordance with quintessential instructions, special experience is generated that can redirect the mind well. This is like tasting sugarcane itself. Therefore, it is fully qualified as a mind generation. So once more, the idea here is that, as I pointed out earlier, when we talk about mind of enlightenment or mind generation or bodhicitta, whatever you want to call it over here, it's just sort of giving the name of that to the thoughts that we are generating. Just like when we cultivate bodhicitta before classes like we did tonight, we are doing it in a contrived way. We are thinking about various things that feed into it, and we generate that thought. We can call it bodhicitta, but it's not fully qualified bodhicitta. Why? Because we haven't generated it through the force of our familiarity and meditation into uncontrived bodhicitta, which is, again, what happens right after you cross that line. That is the actual thing that is concurrent with becoming a bodhisattva. So essentially this first objection that's being put forward is dismissed, because we're not talking about apples and apples. We're talking about apples and oranges. We're talking about this mind of bodhicitta that we generate in a contrived way and that's not spontaneous in any way, and then the spontaneous uncontrived mind that arises after familiarity. So it's not complete apples and oranges, because this develops into that. But nonetheless, we aren't talking about the fully qualified mind of bodhicitta being the cause for a bodhisattva. It is once more what defines a bodhisattva, and it is the product of having meditated once more on the two main techniques for developing bodhicitta: the sevenfold cause and effect method, where we see sentient beings as having been our mother and generate a closeness towards them and then want to repay the kindness they have shown us, and so on. We generate love and compassion and generate the altruistic intention on the basis of this special thought of benefiting them to the greatest degree. And then we have the second technique of equalizing and exchanging self and others, which is directed at addressing the mind of self-centeredness, self-cherishing, that is problematic, that keeps us from being fully committed to the welfare of others. And again, we use techniques to generate love and compassion there, specifically the technique of Tonglen that many of you know. But essentially, this is a similar process that arrives at the same conclusion, that we have to become a Buddha for the sake of others. So all the work that all of you do right now in generating bodhicitta and everything that precedes bodhicitta, the mind of great compassion that is the focus of this course, all of that contributes to that kind of crossing the threshold and becoming a bodhisattva when you generate that uncontrived bodhicitta. But we're not talking about that being on the other side of it. It's not a cause of a bodhisattva. It is what, again, is arising on the basis of the cause that is our meditation on bodhicitta, as well as, you know, other factors. So essentially, this is what's being said by Tsongkhapa in addressing that first objection. Okay, so then there's a little quote from the questions of Adya Shaya Sutra. Verbalization is like the bark. Contemplating the meaning is like the taste. By the way, I've heard this analogy used for emptiness as well. You know, because when we meditate on emptiness and it's still conceptual, it's like tasting the bark. You know, we don't really know what emptiness is. We're using an idea of what it is on the basis of our conceptual mind. But when we actually have that direct realization I was referring to that we're going to get into next, that's also said to be like the taste of the actual sugar cane. You know, that we're only going to know that when we actually get to that point. So then it goes on to talk about the second objection, which had to do with, again, the wisdom that is non-dual, that is understanding emptiness to some degree. Here, Tsongkhapa says, a bearer of the bodhisattva lineage with sharp faculties first seeks the view of suchness and then generates the altruistic mind. Therefore, as will be explained later, the second fault is also not incurred. So what this is saying is that when this objector was saying, well, you're talking about this non-dual wisdom that is not realized till the bodhisattva is way further down the path, essentially what the objector is being refuted is by saying, we're not talking about that level of an understanding of emptiness. What has to occur, though, for those who are sharp faculty, and by sharp faculty we mean sort of bodhisattvas who are bodhisattva wannabes, who are sort of grounded in reason, they look at it from the point of view of, first, they generate a great compassion because they see the suffering of the world, but they secondly have to examine whether it is possible to attain enlightenment in order to benefit those beings. So before they generate bodhicitta, they go into an investigation of emptiness to see if the means is actually there to accomplish enlightenment, to remove all of the obscurations that keep us from being a Buddha, and by virtue of that, you know, we have confidence that we can actually accomplish what bodhicitta is intent upon. Remember, it's got the object of intent of benefiting all beings, the object of attainment, which is having one's own enlightenment. In order to do that, we have to have some confidence that that's actually attainable. So those bodhisattvas who are a bit more sharp-facultied, who aren't solely entering the path on the basis of faith, do an investigation into emptiness, to want to know that there's some validity to those teachings, that that reasoning will lead to an understanding of the nature of reality that will undermine our own ignorance, our own obscurations, and thereby help us to become a Buddha and aid others in that process. So the whole idea here is that this wisdom that is talked about as non-dual isn't that direct realization. It is the investigation into emptiness at a conceptual level that precedes entering the path. It precedes generating this bodhicitta that is uncontrived. So let's look at what Tsongkhapa says in the next paragraph that goes into a little bit more of what we mean by this non-dual understanding. Because I think we know what great compassion is. We know what altruistic intention, bodhicitta, is. This term might be the most one that requires a little more investigation. Non-dual understanding, he says, does not refer to the absence of that dualistic appearance of object and subject, which occurs later on the path of seeing. I mentioned that a short while ago. That experience, when you directly realize emptiness, is not what's being talked about here. Chandrakirti's commentary explains it as wisdom free from the two extremes. Thus, it is not contradictory for it to occur prior to becoming a bodhisattva. Okay, so what do we mean by these two extremes? Most of you have heard this teaching before, but it's good to go into it again. When we talk about the middle way, which is this view that we are examining in Chandrakirti's text that he goes into great lengths later in chapter 6 when he analyzes the perfection of wisdom, he's talking about this middle way that is between these two extremes. On the one hand, we have the extreme that we have fallen into since beginningless time, the extreme of, it's often called permanence or a sort of eternalism, a holding to the essence of things as if they existed inherently. So this is, again, the error that we've been making since beginningless time, that, you know, we've need to start questioning and examining and overcoming through the wisdom realizing emptiness to move away from that. The problem sometimes is when we begin to move away from that through examining emptiness, we fall into the other extreme. The other extreme is the extreme of annihilation, a sort of nihilistic view where suddenly when we negate the inherent existence of things, we end up negating the mere existence of things. By virtue of that, everything falls apart. Then there's no karma, there's no rebirth, there's no enlightenment, there's no liberation, there's no path, there's nothing. You know, so when you read something like the Heart Sutra and you hear those sorts of words, there's, you know, no suffering, no origination of suffering, no cessation, no path, we might think, oh, well, then there's nothing. You know, what's the point? I just sit there and focus my mind on nothing existing at all, and somehow I'll end up getting liberated from it all. Well, that's not the answer that the Buddha taught, to annihilate things utterly, to get rid of them in their entirety. Rather, what we're talking about is to remove the misconception we have about things, which is their inherent existence, which is what's keeping us over in this extreme. So we have to find this middle way that is clear of those two extremes by understanding very accurately what we mean by inherent existence, removing that and not removing mere existence. Otherwise, we fall into the other extreme. So this is why the middle way is such an important thing for us to continually investigate, because otherwise we're bound to fall into one of these two extremes. Lama Tsongkhapa, in his Lam Rim Chenmo, the great treatise, goes to great lengths to talk about an object of negation that is too great, where we end up falling into the extreme of annihilation because we've negated too much, or an object of negation that's not, you know, big enough. So it's not getting us far enough away from what we have such conviction in since beginningless time through the force of our ignorance. So this middle way is a sort of dance we do between these two extremes until we find that sort of razor edge, that is the correct view of emptiness between those two. So going back to our text, what Tsongkhapa is explaining in terms of Chandrakirti's using this as one of the main causes of a bodhisattva, which again he's citing Nagarjuna in doing that, is this idea once more of non-dual understanding, referring to that investigation that goes on conceptually before one enters the path. You know, doing a deeper investigation into all the teachings on emptiness, the reasonings, coming to the conclusion that, yes, I can see some reality of emptiness that isn't involved in either of those two extremes, that still upholds the nature of reality so we don't completely annihilate it, but also gets rid of this distorted view of reality so that we don't adhere to that and get in the same trouble that we've been in since beginningless time. So this is what is meant by this. And of course, as I said, the sharp faculty bodhisattva does that investigation because they want to be convinced that the attainment of enlightenment is possible. I mean, it makes some sense, right? If you're going to embark on something that is your journey for the rest of eternity until you attain Buddhahood, and then, of course, your accomplishment in the state of Buddhahood that will go on for eternity, you want to have some conviction that this is possible to accomplish, right? Otherwise, maybe, you know, we're barking up the wrong tree or something. But, you know, if we do that investigation, maybe we're all sharp faculty, because in this tradition, you do an awful lot of study of emptiness before you even, you know, enter into the Mahayana path. But it is good to have that. That. Because once more, that's the grounding in wisdom from which our compassion then comes to its fruition in bodhicitta. So again, the methodology is first we become motivated by some level of compassion. Hopefully it's a great compassion that sees the suffering of beings and really feels the need to protect them from that. On the basis of that, we hear, oh, we can attain a Buddhahood to do that. We investigate, well, is it possible to attain Buddhahood? Does this wisdom exist, and is it something I can rely upon? And if it is, then I'll commit. You know, then sign me up. Then I'll become a bodhisattva, and I'll enter the path, and I'll do all the work that needs to be done for the three great countless eons and what have you, and become a Buddha through all of that work and effort. So again, this is what's being talked about here. This is what Tsongkhapa is explaining in terms of Chandrakirti's verse. Okay, so now just to conclude that paragraph, he mentions Jayananda. Again, remember, Jayananda came up last week. He's this, or maybe even the week before, but anyway, he's the another commentator on Chandrakirti's text, who sometimes explains things incorrectly, sometimes correctly. And here he's going to take issue with Jayananda's explanation. So Jayananda explains that non-dual understanding refers to an ultimate mind generation, meaning the mind of the bodhisattva that is directly realizing emptiness. That is, you know, of course, together with bodhicitta, we call it often ultimate bodhicitta, which involves the non-appearance of subject and object and begins with the path of seeing. You know, in his explanation, Tsongkhapa says, it's quite senseless because non-dual understanding must also indicate the wisdom that is a cause of a bodhisattva newly entering the path. So he's essentially writing off Jayananda's comment, though he would, of course, you know, include that in this non-dual understanding, but it's not just that. It includes all of what occurs before one enters the path. And of course, that continues and generates into deeper and deeper wisdom that eventually becomes non-dual in this way that's described, the non-appearance of subject and object at the path of seeing. Okay, so now we are entering into the next outline and the next verse. This is compassion as the root of the other two causes of a bodhisattva. So we just looked at these three causes of a bodhisattva: great compassion, the non-dual understanding, and then the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. As Tsongkhapa says here, compassion is the root of the altruistic mind of enlightenment and non-dualistic wisdom. Therefore, it is the chief of the three causes. Indicating this in his root text, Chandrakirti says, mercy alone, and mercy again, remember, is the translation given to Tsewa, whereas Ningje is usually translated as compassion, but they're equivalent terms. They're talking about the compassion that is focused on the suffering of other beings. So mercy alone is seen as the seed of a conqueror's rich harvest, as water for development, and as ripening in a state of long enjoyment. Therefore, at the start, I praise compassion. So let's take a look at, where was that? It's here, that second handout, the second side here. I think we went through the top part of that where it talks about those three causes. So this is a little section that, again, we're looking at the importance of compassion in the three times. So among the three causes of a bodhisattva, great compassion is singled out as the main cause. Why? Because it is important at the three times. So let's just go through this really briefly on this chart, and then we'll go back to the text. In the beginning, this compassion is said to be like a seed. Compassion is important at the beginning, since just like planting the seed of a fruit tree, one must plant the seed of compassion in order to eventually reap the bountiful harvest. So that's the initial cause, the seed of compassion that the shoot of bodhicitta arises from. Then, in terms of the middle, it is said to be like water that moistens and helps that seed to develop. It's important in the middle, since just as one must continually moisten the fruit plant with water, so too must that shoot of bodhicitta be moistened with compassion. If it is not moistened again and again with the water of compassion, the accumulation of the two collections, the collection of merit or method and the collection of wisdom, will not occur. And there may even be degeneration of bodhicitta, especially at the very beginning of the path when the bodhisattva is still a novice bodhisattva and their bodhicitta is not so strong. So that's the importance of compassion in the middle. In the end, it's like the actual state of ripening. Compassion is important at the end, since just like the state of ripening of a fruit tree, that then becomes a source of great enjoyment and resources for others. The culmination of great compassion is found within the final results of Buddhahood. If one lacks compassion at the end, one will not be a source of enjoyment in use by sentient beings as long as psychic existence exists. So this is, again, just speaking to compassion playing a key role throughout our entire path. This is once more why Chandrakirti is praising compassion at the beginning of this text. At the beginning, it's the seed. In the middle, it's like the water that moistens the seed. In the end, it's like the fruit that is from the ripening of that whole process. And of course, it's not to say that compassion can be absent in that final result, or absent in that final result, because the bodhisattva cannot become a Buddha without having generated all this compassion. When you become a Buddha, your compassion is no longer even conceptual. You just act from that place of compassion. So it's not saying that compassion can be absent in the state of Buddhahood, unlike the two other places where it can be absent, and therefore the bodhisattva doesn't begin their process because there's no seed of compassion, and then also they don't continue their process because it's not moistened through the water of compassion. But rather at the end, the compassion is there, but it's just highlighting how important it is that it's there. You know, a Buddha is dedicated to the welfare of all beings for eternity. There's nothing, again, that they have to do any further to generate the activities of enlightening those beings, benefiting them, teaching the Dharma to them, and so on. They are like a sort of perpetual sort of turbine that continues to spin until psychic existence has ended, until all beings have been brought to the full state of enlightenment. You know, they don't need to think about compassion, generate compassion to strengthen any of their activities. Their very activities are compassion. So this is, again, just speaking to the importance of compassion in these three times, helping bodhicitta to develop, helping it to strengthen and grow, and then eventually for it to ripen into the result of Buddhahood. So now we get a little commentary from that. I won't spend too much time on this because I think it's fairly straightforward. I want to, get into the first of the three types of compassion, where we really start looking more deeply at the state of sentient beings. So Tsongkhapa says, mercy or compassion is important like a seed for the initial development of the marvelous harvest of a conqueror, a Buddha. In the middle, mercy is like water for increase higher and higher. At the end, mercy is like the ripening of a fruit in a state of long enjoyment for trainees. Because mercy or compassion is asserted in this way, I, Chandrakirti, rather than praising hearers, solitary realizers, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, or the two other causes of Bodhisattvas, again, the non-dual understanding or the altruistic mind of enlightenment, Bodhicitta, I praise great compassion at the start of this treatise. So he's really highlighting how compassion is what it all boils down to, how it is really the essence of everything that culminates in the state of Buddhahood, and thereby produces all of the various results of the path. You know, so everything is contingent upon compassion. So then he goes on to say, it is not that Chandrakirti will praise compassion. The immediately preceding indication of its importance in the beginning, middle, and end with respect to growing the harvest of a conqueror is the praise. Remember, he says that at the very end of it, he says, you know, therefore, at the start, I praise compassion. This isn't, you know, like saying he's going to praise compassion. He praises compassion. This is who he is or what he is paying homage to. Rather than any of these other beings, he is bringing compassion to the forefront and saying, this is exactly what we need to really be in awe of and pay homage to, because without compassion, none of these other results arise. Then it says, mercy alone, or compassion alone, indicates that unlike the three different examples of importance, which were the seed, the water, and the ripeness, at the beginning, middle, and end, respectively, for an external harvest, only compassion is important in the beginning, middle, and end for the harvest of a conqueror. Now, it's not denying that there are other causes involved in this. I mean, attaining enlightenment involves myriad causes and conditions, right? You don't just have one thing that ripens into Buddhahood. But compassion is being singled out here as something that plays a key role at the beginning, that is like a seed, in the middle, that is like the water, and at the end, that's like the fruition. But it's not that there's three different things involved here. It's the same thing. Compassion alone, compassion only, that plays this key role through all three stages of the Bodhisattva's development, beginning, middle, and end. So it's just once more focusing on the centrality of compassion and the importance of compassion in all three times. Now he goes into a more detailed explanation of each of these. So the way that compassion's importance in the beginning is like a seed is this. Those who have great compassion generate a mind that observes their object of intent, the welfare of others, with the thought, in order to protect all suffering sentient beings pained by misery, I will relieve them from the suffering of psychic existence and definitely establish them in Buddhahood. So seeing that the ability to do this depends upon their own attainment of Buddhahood, they definitely generate a mind-observing enlightenment with the thought, for their sake then, I will definitely attain highest enlightenment. Again, that's the object of attainment. So it begins with the object of intent, with great compassion that sees that these beings are suffering and we want to free them from that misery. But we generate the object of intent because we recognize that it's contingent upon our own attainment of Buddhahood for us to accomplish that. So then he goes on to say, because they understand that such a promise cannot be fulfilled if the practices of giving and so forth, illustrated in Chandrakirti's commentary by non-dualistic wisdom, are forsaken, they definitely engage in these practices, the chief of which is wisdom. So while wisdom is singled out, non-dualistic wisdom or non-dual understanding, we can say implicitly all the other practices of the Bodhisattva are involved in that. But essentially, we don't generate those, you know, to a greater degree until after we have bodhicitta. But even before the path, you don't generate that wisdom that understands emptiness absent of the compassion that wants to benefit others, you know, has that object of intent. Okay, so then it says, therefore, let me pull the screen up a little bit more so it's a little bit further up. Therefore, the seed of all Buddhist qualities is great compassion. This is the first, the compassion at the beginning. So referring to this, Nagarjuna says in his precious garland, who with intelligence would deride deeds motivated by compassion and the stainless wisdom as is taught in the Mahayana? Nagarjuna says that all the meanings of the Mahayana are contained within the three general practices induced by bodhicitta, the altruistic mind of enlightenment that is preceded by compassion, and the particular practice of wisdom free from the stains of conceiving the two extremes. But essentially, he's singling out compassion, the deeds motivated by compassion. You know, this is where all of it arises from. Without that compassion, we don't seek out the wisdom and all the other perfections. We don't even generate bodhicitta without great compassion. Okay. I'll have a little bit more and then we'll take our mid-class break. The importance of compassion in the middle is similar to water. For although the seed of compassion initially grows into the shoot of bodhicitta, an altruistic mind of enlightenment, if later it is not moistened again and again with the water of compassion, one will not amass the two extensive collections, again, the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom, that serve as the causes of the fruit, Buddhahood. The collection of merit ripening into the form bodies of the Buddha, the collection of wisdom ripening into the Dharmakaya, the truth body, wisdom body of a Buddha. In that case, one would actualize the nirvana of either a hearer or solitary realizer if one lacks that compassion. However, if the shoot of an altruistic mind of enlightenment is moistened again and again with the water of compassion, that won't happen. One will actually then actualize the attainment of a Buddha. So let's look at the chart here. Again, so what we're saying here is that compassion's important at the beginning. That's like the seed over here on the far left. But it's important in the middle too, especially like from, you know, entering the path all the way through to the, up until one becomes a Buddha. We're going to talk about when you're a Buddha at the end, when we talk about the conclusion at the end of one's path. But it's important, especially right here at the beginning in the path of accumulation, especially what's called the small level of the path of accumulation. The path of accumulation is that initial path when one has uncontrived bodhicitta newly, and one is still a very, again, novice bodhisattva, and doesn't really have the strength of bodhicitta that you will have further down the road. Well, in the very first of these three levels of the path of accumulation, the small, it's said that your bodhicitta can weaken and you can actually degenerate to the fundamental vehicle motivation. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to just go down a little bit, which is the motivation of the hearers and solitary realizers, where you only want to become liberated from your own suffering. So you'll notice that this third circle here is when you enter into the medium or middle level of the path of accumulation. Circle three in the little milestones box there says you will never fall to a lower vehicle, meaning that once you have strengthened your bodhicitta and accumulated the requisite merit and wisdom to get you to the medium or middle level of the path of accumulation, your bodhicitta won't degenerate to the Hinayana. You won't lose that bodhicitta motivation and aspire only for your own liberation. So what is being said by Chandrakirti and, of course, by Tsongkhapa in his commentary is that if the bodhisattva doesn't take care, especially at the beginning when they've entered into the path, not prior to and, you know, entering in initially, but when they are beginning their path, that's sort of, again, part of the middle. The middle is the longest part of it, from when you are actually on the path of accumulation to when you finish the path of meditation. If you don't take care, especially at the beginning, you could have that degeneration into the lower vehicles. Again, we use lower meaning it's got the motivation that is only one's own liberation, that individual motivation, whereas the bodhisattva wants to ideally have the universal motivation that is out to benefit all sentient beings. So the idea here is that it's singling out that particular part of the path, that small level of the path of accumulation. But it's also still very important that the bodhisattva continues to meditate on compassion. You would think, oh, I become a bodhisattva, what do I need to meditate on compassion for? I've already got bodhicitta. But it actually continues to be an important factor of practice because it continues to strengthen and build our bodhicitta. There actually are said to be 22 similes for the various levels of bodhicitta as one enters the path, and then eventually when one becomes a Buddha. But essentially that mind continues to grow and develop, and what causes it to grow and develop is compassion that we continually are bringing to mind and kind of infusing into our motivations, our actions, what have you. So the bodhisattva just becomes more and more compassionate until eventually that compassion is the compassion of a Buddha, which is compassion at the end. So let's take a look at that, and then we'll take our break. The importance of compassion at the end is similar to this state of ripeness. For if one attains the state of a conqueror but lacks the ripened state of compassion, one will not be a source of enjoyment and use by sentient beings as long as psychic existence lasts. As I said earlier, it's impossible for you to become a Buddha and have that absent. You won't ever become a Buddha without compassion being there. But nonetheless, it's saying if you were to highlight all the qualities of a Buddha that are so important for attaining the object of intent and benefiting all beings, it's their compassion. That compassion is what has ripened into their endless, spontaneous, effortless, enlightened activities. All the things that a Buddha does to benefit sentient beings are the product of that compassion. And it says also the collection of hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattva superiors arising from the transmission of Buddha's word from one to the other would not increase uninterruptedly. You know, there wouldn't be the continual flow of the Dharma if the Buddhas didn't have this compassion that wants to benefit others through teaching the Dharma. However, when great compassion operates continually at Buddhahood, the opposite occurs. So again, this is the whole idea that when you become a Buddha, that compassion is this, you know, perpetually generating enlightening activities for the benefit of all beings. There's that compassion takes that form. Remember, Buddhahood is often described in terms of being like the sun shining. Of course, we know that our own sun at some point will extinguish, will explode. You know, there won't be any sun in this solar system any longer. But the sun of the Buddha will be there for eternity until all beings are free from their state of unenlightened existence. And so they are just shining out the rays continually of enlightened activity. The sun doesn't think, oh, should I shine some rays down on Raleigh, North Carolina today? No, I don't think I will. The only reason why we don't see the sun, perhaps, is because there are clouds between the ground and the sun. But the sun is always there shining. Even at nighttime, the sun is still there doing its thing, shining the light rays out. This is what a Buddha is doing continually. Now, where does this come from? Compassion. Of course, it's got its source also in the wisdom mind of the Buddha that knows exactly how to benefit those beings. That's where those light rays help beings very specifically in relationship to their own individual karma. But nonetheless, what causes them to be generated, what causes those activities to be cultivated, is compassion. So compassion at the end is extremely important, because otherwise we wouldn't have the resultant state of Buddhahood. So let's look at the last of this, and we'll take our break. Through Chandrakirti's commentary on the meaning of these four lines, you should gain firm conviction with respect to the teaching that it is necessary to train in these practices. You should think, if I wish to become a Mahayanist, a Bodhisattva, and then a Buddha, my mind must first come under the influence of great compassion. And then, in dependence on this, I must generate from the depth of my heart a fully qualified altruistic mind of enlightenment. Once I have done this, I must engage in the general practices of bodhisattvas, and in particular, I must penetrate the profound view of emptiness, that again is the main topic that Chandrakirti addresses in this text later in the sixth ground, the chapter on wisdom. Okay, so that was the conclusion of the homage to great compassion without differentiating the types of compassion, just talking about compassion in general. This great compassion that we've seen is the root cause of generating the other causes of a bodhisattva, that then that bodhisattva comes from, that bodhisattva becomes a Buddha, that Buddha helps hearers and solitary realizers on their path. Without this whole process arising from the root of great compassion, none of those results would ensue. This is what Chandrakirti is essentially saying in that first two verses. So let's take our break, and when we come back, we'll get into the first of the three types of compassion, where we see that we are differentiating the types of compassion that are based on how we are observing sentient beings, the sorts of thoughts that we are cultivating in regard to the qualities or aspects of those sentient beings that are the objects we are observing and cultivating compassion in relationship to. All right. So let's say I've got about three after the hour, but let's say it's four after the hour, because it will be by the time I stop talking. So at 14 after, I'll just go with 15 after. Why not give you an extra minute? So quarter after, we'll resume. And I'll ring my bell here. So if you keep your speaker on, you'll hear it when the break is over. All right. Have a good break. Okay, welcome back. In the Zoom room, I've put a meditation in the chat box that I put together on the basis of, I'll mention the source of that in a moment, but anyway, I'll talk about that shortly, but I just wanted to make sure people know that that is out there, and you can download it from the chat box if you'd like a copy of that yourself. It's a meditation on the three types of compassion that we're going to be going into next. I thought I would open it up to questions at this point. Normally I do that at the very end of the class, but since we're at the end of a section, ready to start a new section, maybe better to see if there are any questions that anyone has from what I've covered so far, all the way up to this point through the last two sessions as well as tonight. Any questions or comments? Criticisms? I'm open to whatever. Okay, so again, this next part is a really important part, because this is where, when I came up with the title for this course, Uniting Wisdom and Compassion, this is the idea behind it, is that we really want to be able to inform our compassion with more insight. One of the books that has some reference to these teachings is actually a wonderful little book called How to See Yourself as You Really Are, His Holiness the Dalai Lama with Jeffrey Hopkins. At the very tail end of this book that's mostly about emptiness, he brings in this particular part of the homage from Chandrakirti, and essentially talks about these three types of compassion. So I just want to read the little paragraph that is the beginning of that section. This is page 201 of How to See Yourself as You Really Are. Even though it is necessary in the beginning to have a strong will in order to develop love and compassion, will is not sufficient to develop these altruistic attitudes limitlessly. It is important to join the practice of love and compassion with the practice of insight. Even if you seek to help someone out of concern, without insight, you cannot be very clear about what benefits will come of your efforts. A combination is needed, a good human heart as well as a good human brain. With these working together, we can achieve a lot. And this is often how we talk about these sort of two aspects of the path, you know, our wisdom aspect as well as our sort of method, compassion aspect. Is one is very heart-based, the other very head-based, but we need both. You know, if we have a compassion that is generated to this degree where we really feel for the suffering that other beings are going through, but maybe we don't clearly understand the causes of that suffering, or we don't understand how to address those causes, or we don't understand even the deeper sources of error that sentient beings are making that contribute to that, we're going to be very ineffective in actually helping them to be free from that suffering. Of course, everything that is generated in terms of these three types of compassion feeds into the resultant state of Buddhahood, where we have that compassion and wisdom, you know, perfected, brought to their culmination in terms of the state of Buddhahood. But until we get there, we have to feed both sides of it. If we simply feed the compassion side and we really just, you know, get so moved by the suffering of others, but we don't accompany it with the wisdom perspective, we're never going to achieve the state where we can truly benefit those beings. So our bodhicitta is very much contingent upon that. And once more, if we look at the two aspects of bodhicitta, the object of intent is our compassion piece, right, to benefit all sentient beings. The object of attainment is the wisdom and peace, to develop our own minds fully so that we then know exactly how to benefit others. But even in our situation now, before we're a Buddha, We have to be able to understand clearly why it is that sentient beings are suffering, how it is that we can begin to help them, what it is that will help ourselves and others to achieve even more, you know, peace while we are in samsara, and of course eventually attaining liberation and enlightenment. So this is the whole idea behind it. Now as we look at these three, let me give you a little preview of what these three essentially are. The first one is sometimes called, you know, compassion observing sentient beings. Jeffrey Hopkins, the other book that I'm going to be quoting from and that I've used as a source for the meditation that's in the chat box, and yes, it can be uploaded with the other documents for this class so anyone can have access to it. It was originally published as this book, Cultivating Compassion, by Jeffrey Hopkins, but know that I think this was a smaller publishing house, and it was turned over to Snow Lion Publications that many of you know. And there it was published with a different title. It's called A Truthful Heart. Both of those titles are in that file at the very end. I give credit to Jeffrey Hopkins and those sources in terms of my putting together that meditation. But essentially what we have is the initial form of compassion that we are generating as the first of the three types is observing sentient beings through the lens of them being qualified by their suffering. But not just, again, at a very cursory level, an understanding of everything that is involved with their suffering. So we bring in a lot of different teachings that most of you have come across here and there, the 12 links of dependent arising, the various realms of existence, what have you. And we put into a very composite view of how it is that sentient beings are suffering. Because right now our compassion is somewhat limited. We only have compassion often for the beings who are suffering in very gross ways, manifest ways, that are experiencing pain and difficulty. We don't really get the extent to which beings are suffering and have been suffering since beginningless time. So that's what we're going to go into first. And there's a wonderful analogy that Chandrakirti introduces for that. We're going to see sentient beings as being like a bucket in a well. And there'll be various aspects of that analogy that play out in terms of Buddha's teachings. The second type of compassion is where we begin to see sentient beings through the lens of understanding their impermanence. Here, they're not qualified by their suffering, because that's the first one, but rather by their impermanence, the fleeting nature of those beings. Which, of course, the biggest problem is that sentient beings are clinging to themselves as not being impermanent, holding on to some view of permanence and eternal kind of existence, and never wanting to think about themselves going out of existence. This is why death is so frightening for so many people, is because we cling to something permanent about our being. This permanence that, of course, is belied by the reality of things constantly changing momentarily, every moment, changing within that, and then grosser levels of change that happen when we experience death and so on. But sentient beings cling to the opposite of that. Instead of recognizing their own impermanence, they cling to the opposite, thinking that they are somehow permanent, unchanging. The third of the three types of compassion is where we recognize sentient beings as being qualified by their emptiness of inherent existence. The fact that although sentient beings cling to the opposite there, thinking they exist intrinsically, substantially, in reality, we could even say, because our view of reality is so tainted by that mistaken idea, sentient beings don't have that existence at all. They lack that. So in a sense, what we're talking about here is, because even when we go back to the first one, and by the way, I'll talk about the analogy that's used for the other two. It's a similar analogy, just with two different kind of aspects of it. The first one, when we talk about sentient beings qualified by their suffering, well, most beings are not aware of the extent to which they have been involved in samsara and experiencing dukkha, right? When you first encountered the Buddha's teachings, I doubt very much that you had this idea that you had been experiencing samsara since beginningless time and all the various levels of suffering and what have you. Most beings are ignorant to that fact. They think this is the life they get. Sometimes that's all that they adhere to, is when this life ends, that's the end of life, or they have some other view of what comes after this life. But essentially they are dealing with a mistaken idea about how it is that they are suffering and why they are suffering. With regard to the second type of compassion, they're also, as I said, mistakenly thinking things are permanent, especially themselves, unchanging, when in reality they are changing every moment. The third, clinging to that inherent existence that is refuted through emptiness, they cling to as if they actually did exist that way. So all three of these are cases where sentient beings are usually not as well informed as they should be. So we're going to kind of unite our own wisdom, realizing sentient beings as suffering to the extent that they are, as impermanent, because that is their conventional nature as well, and then lacking inherent existence, empty of that, which is their ultimate nature. And in that way, understand not just the reality of those beings conventionally and ultimately, but also develop an even deeper compassion, because sentient beings are going around with minds that are completely ignorant as to the nature of conventional reality and, of course, certainly to ultimate reality. I came across a quote the other day as I was preparing another class that I thought was so appropriate for these teachings on these three types of compassion. And this is essentially, if I can get that little thing to move, there it goes for me. All right, now I can do the slideshow. This quote's from Noam Chomsky, and I don't think he's necessarily, or maybe he is Buddhist, I really don't know much about him, but a lot of Buddhists use this in talking about the reality of beings. People not only don't know what's happening to them, they don't even know that they don't know. And this is kind of the flavor of what we're getting into with these three types of compassion, that we are looking at sentient beings with the understanding of what is happening to them, but the recognition that not only do they not know that, not only do they not know the extent to which they are suffering, that they've been involved in this since beginningless time and so on, that they are impermanent, changing moment by moment, that they lack inherent existence, they are empty of that, but they don't even know that they don't know. This is what should really break our hearts, is that when we look at beings, we see them through that lens of understanding that they are veiled with ignorance to such a high degree. And even when we see our own efforts at maybe trying to poke some light through that veil of ignorance that they are experiencing, we see how futile it can be at times. And this is once more the recognition that our compassion gets channeled into bodhicitta, because we have to become a Buddha to become more skillful and adept at helping sentient beings to cut through that veil of ignorance. So I like that quote because it really does speak to what we are working with when we get into these three types of compassion. We're uniting our own wisdom with our understanding of the situation of beings so we generate greater compassion, but we also are looking at it from the point of view of those beings being completely blind once more to the conventional reality, that they are caught up in samsara and experiencing it due to all the various causes and conditions, that they are impermanent. Those are the conventional nature of their existence that they are blind to. And then the ultimate nature of existence, the emptiness. Those sentient beings lack they don't even have an atom of inherent existence. They lack inherent existence totally and completely. But they believe in the opposite. They are holding strongly to the opposite. So once more, not only do they not know, but they don't even know they don't know. So I don't know if that's effective in my way of presenting it, but when I came across that quote, I thought it really contributes a lot. To how we are trying to approach compassion in regard to this. So let me introduce the first type of compassion again with this analogy of a bucket and a well by showing you just a little slide with a quote from Tsongkhapa's commentary that we'll go into in just a moment. He says, Chandrakirti's homage to compassion observing sentient beings or observing suffering sentient beings is homage to compassion for migrators wandering powerlessly like a bucket traveling in a well. Again, there are different ways that this bucket and a well are set out in terms of what it looks like, but this is the one that we tended to use, and we talked about this in the master's program. This mechanism that's called a windlass that essentially allows the bucket to go down in the well to collect water and then to be pulled up to the top of the well and be emptied. But again, we're not necessarily looking at that aspect of it so much as the experience of being the bucket in the well. All right. So this is what we're going to get into in terms of Master Chandrakirti's verse, and then again Tsongkhapa's commentary on that. So let's go ahead and go into that. And as I said, I've got this meditation that I've put together from Jeffrey Hopkins' teachings, his text. And I don't know that I'll have time to lead a meditation. Maybe at the beginning of next week I'll do the first part on this section. But I thought it would be good for you to have that to work with meditating on all three of these types of compassion. So this section, Homage to Great Compassion Within Differentiating Its Types, is divided into two parts. The first of the three compassions is going to be talked about separately. Then we're going to have the homage to compassion that is observing phenomena. That's the way we talk about impermanence. And then the unapprehendable, which is the way we talk about the emptiness of inherent existence. And I'll get to explaining those when we get to them next week. So homage to compassion observing these suffering sentient beings. So here Chandrakirti says in verse 3, homage to that compassion for migrators who are powerless like a bucket traveling in a well. Through initially adhering to a self, an I, and then generating attachment for things, this is mine. So even though, again, we're not going to talk about emptiness as being the aspect that we are observing sentient beings through until the third type of compassion, we are already bringing to bear an understanding of how they are under the control of their ignorance. Specifically, they're clinging to an I, a self-existent person that they are, and then that person becoming a possessor, thinking of things as being mine. Let's look at what Tsongkhapa says in regard to that verse. He highlights at the very beginning what is talked about in the last two lines, what we often call the view of the transitory collection. He says here that that view as a real I generates the view of that collection as a real mine. Therefore, these sentient beings initially, prior to the view of the transitory adhering to real mind, adhere to an I as a truth. The view of the transitory apprehending a real I thinks that the self, which does not inherently exist, does so. Subsequently, the view of the transitory apprehending real mine generates attachment for the truth of the mine, thinking this is mine, with respect to phenomena other than the I, such as forms and eyes. Okay, so there's a lot to explain in there. Let me take it off screen and talk first about what we mean by this view of the transitory collection. Those of you who have studied any of the Madhyamika sort of classes or even in Minds and Mental Factors, you'll have heard of this particular view. It's one of what are called the five afflicted views. It's the most important. And when we talk about the root of samsara or psychic existence, Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa and all the other great teachers of the middle way say this is the actual operative root. Because although we say that ignorance grasping at inherent existence is what's keeping us bound in samsara, it is specifically the ignorance grasping at this I, this person that we think is so real, that we are continually invested in lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And then that I becomes a possessor. It's not just a simple thought of there being a real I here. That I gets involved in things. It gets involved in the collection, the transitory collection itself. By transitory collection, when we say the view of the transitory collection, we're essentially talking about what are often called the five aggregates, but they can be narrowed down into two main things. The first aggregate form is our body, and the other four, which are feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness, those four we can lump together as mind. So essentially we have body and mind, the mind-body complex. This collection of stuff, this aggregation of stuff, is the basis for a person. If you have a person, you are positing that there is a mind there, and you're positing that there is a body, some form of some type, even in what's called the formless realm. There's always some very subtle wind energy that's together with the body, with the mind, they say. So in that way, there's some form of form, even though we call it the formless realm. And we'll talk about the formless realm a little later tonight. But essentially, what we mean by the transitory collection is the basis that we think of as I. every existence that we've had, there's been a mind and there's been some form that that mind is together with. In this case, we have the human mind, that consciousness, and of course all the various levels of mind that are within that, but then the human body that we are together with. That basis, that transitory collection, transitory because it is changing momentarily, it's never staying the same, that collection is simply designated as I. This is the reality of things, and we'll talk about that more next week when we get into the third type of compassion. But in the end, there's really just a thought of I we have in relation to this collection. There's no real I here, but we think there's a real I. That I is designated to this collection, and we kind of elevate it to a greater sense of being, thinking that there's a real I here, that there's something substantial to that I. When again, that I is simply a thought, a designation that we give to this transitory collection. So, according to the middle way view that we are studying in this text by Chandrakirti, when we have this view of the transitory collection that is the sense of an I that is based on the mind and body, we are holding that I that is merely designated to be real. And then that I gets involved with things, as I was saying earlier, and starts thinking of them as being mine. Now, we're not talking about, when we say the view of the transitory collection observing mine, we're not talking about the things that are possessed, like my computer or my clothes or my whatever, or my body, my mind. We can possess, you know, even things that are kind of in our own continuum. But nonetheless, what we're talking about is the possessor, the sense of an I that possesses things. So when we talk about the view of the transitory collection observing I and observing mine, they're both referring to this person that we think is so real. That person that is established just as an identity on the basis of this collection of stuff that we hold to be a real I, this I that's only designated, we think has a greater reality than just that designation. We think it is real much more so than that. Or we think of the I that is possessing all these things as being real. But it's not the things themselves. That's a different type of misconception. This view of the transitory collection is observing the person that is in our own continuum and thinking that is a real person, whether it's the I that's being designated or the mine. You know, I've taught on this recently, and I still keep coming to the conclusion that this almost would be better being labeled as the my, M-Y, rather than mine. And why is because my has that sense of the person that is possessing something, whereas mine seems to be the object that is possessed, but I don't know, that's my own thinking. But it's the sense of an I or my that we are continually engaged in that is the source of all of our other faults, right? So when we cling it to inherent existence at computers, for example, we can, you know, have that conception that our computer is real from its own side, that it substantially exists and inherently exists. But it doesn't become problematic until I start thinking of it as my computer, right? Now, that's when I, you know, make sure that I don't leave it somewhere where somebody's going to take it, or I become very possessive around it, making sure people aren't, you know, leaving some, you know, sticky substance near it that will, you know, fall onto it, some soda or something that will ruin it. You know, I get all of this attachment to things and an aversion to harm to them because there's a person that those things revolve around, that is the person that is possessing all of those things. This is the root of our problems. Again, what we call the view of the transitory collection that observes the I to be real or the sense of my or mine to be real. But they're both, again, this person that we feel has to be real. We've been convinced of its reality since beginningless time. Going back to that Noam Chomsky quote, most sentient beings don't even know that they don't know the nature of this I. They haven't ever even thought about investigating the nature of the I. They simply live their lives with that ignorance without raising any sort of question about it. So again, this should already be breaking our hearts when we see that this is how sentient beings are getting into trouble, is that they are rotating their whole existence around this false sense of an I. And we'll talk even a little bit more next week about what we mean by that sense of a real or inherently existent I, these phrases that we use. But again, going back to this paragraph, this view of the transitory collection as a real I generates the view of that collection as real mine, you know, because that's how what we think of my body, my mind. We think of them as a real mine. We think of them as really being the possessions of a real person. But we're not talking about the possessions. We're talking about the person that owns those, the person that has the relationship with those. So again, we initially adhere to an I, and on the basis of that, we get involved with all the various things, not just our own aggregates that we think of as mine, but also all the various things in the world that we possess. Let me just take it off screen one more time and talk about this whole thing that, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks about how this mind becomes operative in terms of examples like when we go into a store to buy something nice and say we're looking, you know, it's we're just feeling like we'd like to get something nice for our home, maybe our mantelpiece or something, that we're looking for the perfect object, and we know we see something there and we begin to be attracted towards it. Of course, its attraction isn't inherent either, but once we make the decision based on its attractiveness and the way that we are seeing that object to possess it, then we have a very different relationship with that object. If prior to your taking it home and then putting it on your mantelpiece, if prior to all of that, before you, you know, bought it, it fell and broke into a million pieces, we wouldn't even think anything about it. Why? Because it's not mine, right? We don't have that strong connection that sort of is embedded into the object. But once we have it as mine, I mean, even if we don't pay for it, maybe somebody gives you this beautiful thing and, you know, they see that you were looking at it at the store, they were with you shopping that day, and so they go back and they buy it for you. And then you have it as mine. Well, then if you put it on your mantelpiece and the cat knocks it off the mantelpiece, well, then you get really upset, right? Because it was mine. We can see how it's the same object, whether it's in the store or whether it's with your friend who bought it for you or whether it's actually in your own possession. The object hasn't changed. It's your relationship to these objects that has changed. So this is the way the view of the transitory collection works. It first grasps at the sense of I. From that place of that I, we start thinking of these various things as mine. That I becomes a possessor. And then that I gets bent out of shape when things threaten that thing we own, whatever it is, so that we then have anger and aversion rising. And of course, that's based on our attachment, our grasping at it. These two modes that we are continually involved in, of the attachment and then the aversion to anything that threatens that attachment, this is all rooted in that strong clinging to this sense of I and that I as a possessor. So maybe I've said enough about it, but I think, again, a lot of you have had exposure to this idea, but if you haven't, maybe it takes a little while to kind of get our heads around that. So again, this is going back to the verse. This was the two lines at the bottom there, through initially adhering to a self, an I, and then generating attachment for things. This is mine. So this is kind of a qualification we're putting on these beings in this verse, but we're mostly trying to understand the whole process by which they are suffering. So this is going to come into play shortly when we look at this bucket analogy. Okay, so that was the phrase at the top of the screen there. That's what I shared on the screen, the PowerPoint slide with you, with the little picture of the man at the well. Chandrakirti's homage to compassion observing sentient beings is homage to compassion for migrators wandering powerlessly like a bucket traveling in a well. So the question arises, in what way are migrators similar to a bucket in a well? The answer is that sentient beings are the bearers of similarity, and a bucket in a well is the object of similarity, both having six features, such as being tied. Okay, so let's look at each of these six features. And these are also reiterated on handout number 3. I don't know that I'm going to go through that as well. We'll just see again how it goes with regard to going through these tonight. First, sentient beings, the first feature is that these worldly beings, these sentient beings, are bound very tightly by the rope of contaminated actions and afflictions, karma and delusions or afflictions. In Chandrakirti's commentary, the word these should be applied to the other five features as also. So this is just making a reference to Chandrakirti's auto-commentary. It's not so important. But the first feature of analogy is that just as that bucket is tied by a rope to the whole mechanism, Worldly beings are bound by karma and delusions. Their contaminated actions, contaminated by their ignorance, as well as the ignorance and the other afflictions that keep them perpetuating this whole process. So that's the first analogy. The second is that the process of psychic existence depends on being impelled by the mind, like the operator of the pulley mechanism. So here, you know, when we saw the little picture, you always have like somebody who's the operator of the well, right? Who's turning the windlass so that the bucket comes up and the bucket goes down. Well, what is causing you to go in the well and to be, you know, in that whole process? It's your own mind. Again, as I pointed out in the meditation tonight, you know, the Buddha didn't say that the causes of our dukkha, of all of our experience, is outside of ourselves, is somebody else, that person who's behind the curtain is someone else. It's our own minds that are behind the curtain. It is our own minds that are creating our own problems. And of course, it's quite specifically the view of the transitory collection, which is a mental state, which is a mental factor, which we never question, and we keep perpetuating, keep clinging to that sense of an I, and then that sense of a mind that adheres to objects as mine. And so we keep getting caught up in the same process because we have an untamed and unpeaceful mind. So this is what the second similarity is, that sentient beings are impelled by their minds in the way that the bucket going up and down in the well is impelled by the operator of the mechanism, the person who is actually taking the bucket up and down and all around throughout the well. Okay, let's go on to the next page. The third similarity is that these sentient beings ceaselessly wander in the great well of psychic existence. From the peak of psychic existence, which is up in the fresher air and the light of the top of the well, all the way down to the most torturous hell that is in down in the wet, dank, damp bottom of the well. So let's do take a look here at the... let's see where I have that. Oh, there we go. This is the six analogies, or six similarities set out here on their handout number 3. This is the various realms of psychic existence that are being referred to here. Most of you are familiar with these. We have 4 formless realms that are said to be much subtler states. I mentioned formless realms earlier, that even in the formless realm, although it says formless without form, there's still a sort of subtle wind energy that's together with the mind. But these are states that you can develop through meditative concentration, where you refine your awareness to a great degree. And then when you exit a life like this after having done that, you can take rebirth in these realms. It's not really a realm, like a place. You just, your consciousness abides in that state until the karma for that is exhausted, and then you fall from that state. Every one of these realms, from peak of psychic existence down to the hell realms, and there are, you know, many different realms within the hell realms, all of them are temporary states that are conditioned by our karma. When the karma is exhausted for any particular realm, we then take rebirth in another realm based on what karma ripens at the end of that existence. So we have been in every one of these states of existence, the 4 formless realms, the 4 form realms, the 6 desire realms, where we are right now. If we have, I put in one of those little "you are here" arrows, it would be in the human realms, which is the bottom of the upper rebirths. We're in like the worst of the upper rebirths, but it's actually said to be a very ideal upper rebirth because the conditions are so conducive to practicing the Dharma. Everything below us are the lower rebirths, the animal realms, the hungry ghosts, the hell realms. And what was being described in that verse or in that commentary by Tsongkhapa is the lowest of the hell realms, which is Avicii, the hell of relentless torment, the most torturous hell that exists. All of these are conditioned by our karma. So when we go back to the Tsongkhapa's text, this similarity, beings are ceaselessly wandering, again, not even to their knowledge. They don't know why they go from existence to existence. They don't even know that they don't know why. They don't even question it, because most beings don't even believe there's something beyond this current existence. They wander through all these various states. this peak of psychic existence, which is the subtlemost state that is the least amount of suffering, but still conditioned by karma and delusions, all the way down to that most torturous hell, and everything in between. Okay, that's the well. The fourth feature is that these sentient beings naturally and effortlessly go downward to bad migrations, but must be drawn with great exertion upward to happy migrations. So this is the only place where we actually get the reference to what, you know, a bucket in a well is doing, right? As I mentioned earlier, usually there's a water at the bottom of the well and you're sending the bucket down, and it, due to the force of gravity, it goes down right really easily, right? You don't have to put much effort into that. You just unloosen the mechanism and it goes immediately down to the bottom. But then to pull it up when it's full of water takes much greater effort. So, wonderful point of analogy. For us to descend to the lower realms doesn't take much effort at all. And we just follow our crazy, deluded minds and we'll create the karma to do that right away. But if we really want to break out of that and get to upper existences or that are less suffering, they say, of course, the human realm in general, not for every human being, is a lot less suffering than any of the three lower rebirths. You know, so we essentially can, you know, change our position within the well through the force of the effort we make, but it takes a lot more effort to go up than it does to go down. There's going to be a quote later from the Buddha where he essentially says that the number of beings who are, you know, take rebirth in these upper realms is very small compared to the beings that take rebirth in the lower realms. And the preponderance of beings that exist are in the lower realms. Okay, the fifth similarity is that they have the three sets of what we call the thorough afflictions, the order of which cannot be determined one pointedly. We can't know where one begins and the other ends. The three sets are, one, the afflictions of ignorance, craving or attachment, and grasping. Two, the actions or karma of compositional action and existence. And three, the productions or the results of consciousness, name and form, six sources, contact, feeling, birth, and aging and death. So most of you should recognize what those are. I actually introduced them in an earlier class. They are what are called the 12 links of dependent origination. Let me put them on the screen. The first three that were mentioned are what we call the thoroughly afflicted class of afflictions themselves. The first one, ignorance. This is the beginning of our process of taking rebirth. Remember, these 12 links were introduced earlier on as the way that the Buddha helps those who want to attain their own liberation, the hearers and solitary realizers, because this spells out very clearly how we are creating the causes for our continued rebirth in samsara. That first moment of ignorance, that is not seeing things correctly, through the force of that, we engage in a compositional action. That's the first of the two links that pertain to action or karma. On the basis of that, that gets imprinted on our consciousness. That consciousness eventually changes into the consciousness where that seed has ripened. It becomes the next existence, which would be our name and form, the fourth link. The name and form are referring to, name is the mental aggregates, form is the physical aggregates. So we acquire new aggregates. Those aggregates generally have what are called the six sense sources. And by the way, I'm just doing a very brief explanation of this because this goes way beyond what we can cover in the time we have left. But most of you hopefully have studied the 12 links or can find His Holiness's book, The Meaning of Life, is a wonderful source to examine these. The six sense sources are the way that we are empowered to know the five sense objects through our physical senses, as well as to know other objects mentally through our mental sense faculty. And then through that, we come into contact with various objects, such as our eye sense power, our eyes being empowered to come into contact with visible form. Then on the basis of our contact, link number 7 on the top of the second column there, a feeling is generated. Maybe we see something pleasant. We then generate a craving and a grasping towards that, the attachment towards that pleasant feeling that is arising on the basis of contact with a particular object. We can come into contact with something that is unpleasant, and we have an unpleasant feeling arises. Then we crave to be separated from that object, and we grasp at having that object, you know, being out of our experience. when that craving and grasping is occurring, those other two afflictions besides ignorance, when that is occurring particularly at the end of a life, they then ripen a karmic action, that is number two, the compositional action that was imprinted on the mind, into a fully potentialized karmic seed. That's link number 10, existence. That existence is calling the cause by the name of the results. It's the karmic seed that has been fully ripened that will propel us into our next existence. Then we take birth and we experience aging throughout that life and eventually die. Now, again, this isn't meant to be a linear process. What's happening is that this actually takes place over two or three lifetimes. Many of you have studied these links and know what's going on. So what is being said here? If we go back to this idea of the similarity between the bucket and the well and these three classes of afflictions, actions, and then the productions or the results of those, is that these sets of the 12 links are always overlapping, and it's impossible to kind of know where one starts and when one stops. Just as with the wheel mechanism, as the rope is turning and what have you, we're never really sure exactly where the bucket is or what's going on. The process, you know, maybe this is a stretching the analogy a little bit, but the process is not so clear. Similarly, with the 12 links of dependent origination, you have them constantly overlapping. In fact, every time we create a karma that can potentially give rise to another rebirth, we've created the first 2.5 links, in a sense. We've had that moment of ignorance that has engaged in the action, karma, compositional action, that has been imprinted on our consciousness, that is waiting for the second half of the third link when it is ripened and goes into the next existence, that consciousness that becomes the consciousness of our next life. So essentially, we keep creating these, and they keep piling up. We've had many of them since beginningless time that are still out there waiting. Why? Because only one karma ripens at the end of each life. At the end of this life, through the force of your craving and grasping that occurs as you're going into the death process, you're going to ripen a seed that will propel you into your next existence. That seems very simple. But again, it's happening within another set of 12 links that ripen into this life, and maybe even influenced by another set of 12 links in which you created that karma. So you have this potentially affecting either two or three lifetimes that are involved in terms of this, you know, coming forward. And by three lifetimes, we don't necessarily mean three consecutive lives. With two, we do mean consecutive lives. But with three, we mean two lives, and then the third one, any number of lives further down the road. But again, I'm not going to go into really detailed teaching on the 12 links. Just know that this is one way that the Buddha talked about how we are caught up in existence through the force of these three contaminated things, our afflictions, especially our ignorance and the craving and grasping that we have at the end of a life, the actions that we engage in, the initial action, and then the ripening of that action that propels us into our next life, and then all the various things in between that are products produced by these two factors. Okay, finally, let's look at the sixth one, and then that's all we're going to have time for tonight. I just wanted to get through at least all these so you can maybe take a look at that meditation in the week between tonight and next week's class. The sixth feature is that every day these sentient beings are battered by the sufferings of pain and change, those first two of the three types that we talked about way back in class one, and the pervasive suffering of being so conditioned as to be always ready to undergo pain. That's the third, the subtlemost type of suffering or dukkha that the Buddha taught. Therefore, these sentient beings do not pass beyond the state of a bucket and a well. That's their experience, to be battered as they go up and down to the various realms of existence, always within the well, sometimes getting to the light and the fresh air at the top, sometimes more often at the bottom, the dark, dank, smelly part of the well. And so essentially, this is a wonderful analogy to examine all the various Buddhist teachings that show what is involved in the state of cyclic existence. Okay, so we're going to look at the rest of this text and get into kind of the additional contemplations on this first type of compassion and then the other two types of compassion next week. But again, please use that meditation to take a look at these factors, and then try to once more not just see this. You certainly can do this in regard to yourself, the instructions of the meditation say to begin with yourself, but it's certainly very valuable also to reflect on that in regard to others, especially that person who is the dearest person in your life, maybe a parent, a partner, a child, a pet, whoever it is that you feel is in that role. Maybe use them over the next week as well to have it really break your heart, to cause your compassion to really well up when you see how they are like this bucket in a well. And once more, to have that recollection that not only do they not know that they're like this bucket in the well under the control of all these various factors, they don't even know that they don't know. They don't even have any mind that kind of goes beyond questioning what is really quite evident and manifest to them, at least most beings who haven't had exposure to these sorts of teachings. All right. So, any questions to wrap up tonight? Anything that anyone wants to ask about anything I covered? It's a lot of words. I'm feeling it in my mouth and throat right now. So sorry to give you so many words, but hopefully they were clear words and able to register some meaning. Anyone? Okay. All right. So again, if you can spend some time with that meditation. Oh, you have a question, Virginia? Or I wasn't sure. Ginger? Okay. No. All right. Good. Just checking. Okay. So again, if you could spend some time with the meditation. As I mentioned, if many of you might have these other books, I know some of the books I've mentioned already might not be things you have on your shelf. Most people have How to See Yourself as You Really Are because you might have done Discovering Buddhism, Wisdom of Emptiness module. I tend to use this for that module. But anyway, the very tail end of that, the chapter is called, let me see if I can find it again. I think I took out the little bookmark here. So it's the whole section is part 6, deepening love with insight, deepening our compassion with, you know, insight into the nature of things. Feel free to read ahead on the other two types of compassion. I've touched on them briefly already, but we'll go into them in more detail next week and even do a little bit of an investigation into emptiness, because that's an important part of this class as well, is to not just, you know, allude to emptiness, but actually look at some of the reasonings that help us to gain a deeper appreciation for that reality. So, all right. I think that's all for tonight then. Let's go ahead and do our dedication prayers. Let me pull those up on screen. Where do I have them now? I've got to wait for that right in the center there where I couldn't get to them. So the first two prayers, the first four lines are dedicating all this positive potential for that result of the attainment of our own enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Once more, both objects, the object of attainment and object of intent, we're making strong prayers that what we've done here tonight become the cause for accomplishing both of those. And then the last four lines where we recall bodhicitta and make this strong wish, this aspiration that bodhicitta be generated very deeply in your own heart, but also in the hearts of all beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. And we go on to do prayers for our precious teachers. As we recite these, many of you have other teachers. We can think about Geshe Gelug and Geshe Tsongpo and all the other teachers that we and others have a karmic connection with, making strong prayers for their good health and long lives. So as we recite these, just feel this opening of your heart to wanting these beings to continue to abide in this world with good health, very long lives, so that we and others can continue to benefit from their magnificent presence. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then for Lama Yeshe's reincarnation, Tenzin Osohita, Venerable One, to you whose kindness exceeds that of all the conquerors, for those wanderers in far-off places, especially the West, mindful of your loving concern for us and intentionally descending again into a family of a far distant land, we make this request. O Lama, please, please live long. And then open your heart to all those beings who you can bring to mind right now who are experiencing the varieties of suffering. Of course, all beings in samsara, as we know from this class, are suffering in some way. But those that you have a particular karmic connection with who are experiencing obstacles or illness, who are dying or who have died, bring them to mind and send this positive energy out to them. Think that it becomes immediately the cause to remove all of their pain and difficulty, and that it also becomes everything that they need to accomplish true peace and happiness. And may all beings find that perfect peace and happiness through what we have done here tonight. Wonderful. Thank you all so much. I'm really enjoying teaching this. It's sad that we're coming down to the last class next week, but I hope it's been of some benefit so far. And next week, again, we'll conclude with those final two types of compassion and finish off this first one. But really focusing on this idea of how do we bring those wisdom teachings, especially what we've already looked at tonight, into our event-generating compassion so that we understand even more deeply the predicament that sentient beings are in and generate an even greater wish to benefit them. All right, everyone, have a good week, and I will see you again next Thursday.